Mark Mattson has joined us on Sports Byline USA. I alluded to before the break that you're an assistant coach at Stanford. You played down at Stanford. Tell me a little bit how you ended up down on the farm.
Well, you know, when I stopped playing basketball in the NBA, I actually had one more year left of my contract. I had just been traded to the Clippers. I had another year left. There were five big guys ahead of me, so it was a mutually negotiated buyout. Decided to coach basketball for the Utah Flash in the Developmental League, and then I decided to go to business school and get my MBA. So I got into Stanford, went there, and through that process, Johnny Dawkins had reached out to me along with his assistant, Mike Schrage, and those two have been together for a long time since their days at Duke. And they reached out, and they basically said, hey, look, Mark, we know you're going to be on campus. We would love for you to have some involvement with the team as a graduate manager while you're there. So when that happened, I felt good inside. I felt happy and I felt excited to be able to work with some of the young players at Stanford. And I also felt honored that Johnny would think highly enough of me to fold me into the program in a limited role. And so the last 2 years I've been doing that. I would say one of the best experiences as part of that process was when Coach Dawkins invited me to join the Stanford team going to Spain last year in the summertime for a summer tournament basically against pro teams over there. I really had the chance to integrate more fully with the team, with the players, with the coaching staff. And I actually think that on that trip, I know I came to feel extremely comfortable and extremely excited to even think about joining the staff at Stanford with Coach Dawkins, his pedigree as a player, as a coach at Duke with Coach Krzyzewski and his work with USA Basketball himself.
Let me take you back to when you played at Stanford, that Final Four berth back in 1998. Mike Montgomery was your coach there, and I've always been enamored with Mike's coaching style. He seems to be a perfect fit, or he was. He's now at Cal, but he was a perfect fit for the farm and the players that he recruited. Why did it all work so well down there?
Mike Montgomery, number one, he's a great human being. Mike Montgomery is a great guy, just an honest guy, and I could feel that when he was recruiting me, when he was in my parents' home, telling me about Stanford. And in fact, that's when I knew I wanted to go to Stanford, and that's the moment that I committed, was when Mike Montgomery was in my parents' home in Danville, California. As he was speaking to me, I knew that I wanted to play for him, and so I told him right then and there, I said, Coach Montgomery, I'm coming to Stanford. And before he had come to the house, I had no idea what I was going to do. But in that moment, I felt so strongly I wanted to go there. I just told him right then and there. But, you know, Mike Montgomery has a unique ability to look at his players and put each player in a position to where they can be very, very successful. For me, you know, Mike Montgomery runs a complicated offense, but the flex cut is part of what we did at Stanford, like really hard, clean flex cuts. And his offense and that system got me point-blank shots at the rim almost every game. It was either a point-blank shot or a little four-foot jump hook, all because of Mike Montgomery's system. If I would have gone to another program, I do not know if I would have made the NBA. I attribute a huge portion of the fact that I was fortunate to be drafted to Mike Montgomery, to the way he challenged me as a player, to the offense that he implemented, and to the other players he brought in to be part of the team. When the team is successful, everyone's successful.
Mark, you bring up a very interesting point, and that is that I think there are certain programs, and I'm going to say Duke, I'm going to say Stanford, Northwestern, the Ivy League schools, in which the emphasis is not so much on the blue-chip player, because invariably they probably are not going to get those players because they can't get them in the schools academically. So therefore, they have to get system players. They have to get players that can play pretty well together in a particular system. Am I correct in that observation?
Yes, you are. Yes, you are. Now, the one caveat would be that the team had so much success that the team and the program started to attract some of the blue-chip players, like a Jason Collins, like a Jaron Collins, a Casey Jacobson, the Lopez twins, Josh Childress. And so that, it's amazing how success will breed success, because I think a lot of those system players that did go into Stanford, you know, I consider myself a system player, you know, but you get enough system players in place that you start winning games, you go to a Final Four, and then all of a sudden, all the top recruits, all the blue chips, they do want to come. And so it kind of breathes on itself, and it kind of really starts attracting some of the guys that might be thinking about a North Carolina at Kentucky. Well, all of a sudden they're saying, hey, Stanford's a pretty great place, too, to play.
Let me go in a different direction. I want to ask you about a couple of things. I know you have publicly said that you were a Boy Scout and that you felt scouting taught you leadership. Can you be a little more explicit about that comment?
I did grow up in the Boy Scouting program, and I have two older brothers, both of which got their Eagle Scout award, and so that was kind of something as a challenge for me. I got it by the skin of my teeth a few days before I turned 18. Probably a few weeks or maybe a month before I turned 18, which is the cutoff. But I feel very proud of that accomplishment. I know that there was a time when I actually had thought about going to the Naval Academy. And I believe if you go into the armed services, if you're an Eagle Scout, you automatically jump one rank or two ranks within the military system. And so that's something that I've always felt very proud of. And in terms of some of the other things about Boy Scouts and some of the personal lessons that I learned, well, one of the big things I learned is, hey, what to do when you make a mistake. I know I've done things in my life that I'm proud of. I've done things in my life that I'm not proud of. I've made small mistakes, big mistakes. You know, we all go through life and we learn. And I think one thing Scouting taught me was, hey, how can I deal? How do I react? How do I respond when I do something stupid? And an example would be I was at a Boy Scout camp, and one of my fellow Boy Scouts, he was a football player at the high school, and I was a basketball player, and he had a big stash of food, and I went in and took some of his food. Well, he got mad and chased me down, and we got into a wrestling match, and we got into a little bit of a fight, and what I did was wrong. What I did was, I was a jerk in that moment, and after we fought and kind of got dusted up a little bit, I went off to my tent and just had time to think to myself, and felt bad about that, But I also knew that, hey, here we're going to be at camp a whole week. We might as well try to get along.
When you went, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask you, when you went to Stanford, were you a couple of years older than the average freshman? Because you went on a mission, did you not, after high school?
That's right.
And so you were out for 2 years on a mission, and so you went to Stanford. Do you feel that, you know, lag time or being a little bit more mature going to college, going to the NBA was helpful to you?
I think it helps and it hurts. When I was playing for the Lakers, Mike Riley, who was then at Sports Illustrated, wrote an article about BYU football. So I went on a Mormon mission, and he wrote an article about BYU football, and he said, hey, look, the BYU football players have a huge advantage because these players go out for 2 years and they lift weights and they eat a lot of food and they mature physically, and then they come back and they're 2 years older, 2 years more mature, 2 years of lifting. Well, I read that and I was in shock. I was upset because the missionary program for the Mormon Church is standard around the world. And I'll tell you this, if you have time to do push-ups twice a week, you're lucky. I mean, I was on a 2-year mission. I probably did about 30 sets of push-ups total because you just don't have any time. You have no time to work out. You have no time to work on any sort of athletic skill development. You know, you're really out there doing missionary work, which was sharing our beliefs about Christ with others, and then also doing community service. And you're so engrossed in those activities that you really have no time to work on anything sports related. And so I wanted to let Sports Illustrated and Mike Riley know. It's Rick Riley I'm talking about, not Mike Riley, Rick Riley. I wanted to let them know that, hey, a mission is not a golden ticket to, you know, becoming a great college athlete or even having an advantage. It took me a year and a half to get my legs back under me after my mission. That's a long time.
You know, having had that experience, which would make you more worldly, and I've often said this, I was talking to Ronnie Lott, the Hall of Famer, one time, and he and I both came from military families, and we both made the observation that kids that come from military families are probably a little bit better adjusted because they've seen the world, you know, their parents being moved all over the world and everything. And I'm just wondering, as you go into professional basketball, which is, you know, nobody can describe what it's like to be a professional athlete. I mean, did you kind of have to shake your head a little bit because you were in Spain, you saw the real world? You saw people that struggled and everything. You lived in communities where you were trying to help them have a better life and everything. And then you go into the luxurious pro basketball world. What was that mind blowing for you?
It was like night and day, and I loved both of them, but it was a huge contrast. You know, in Spain, there were times when we were talking to the people who were the lowest of low, people who had lost limbs, people who were on the streets. Look, we talked to all people. We talked to people of high social class, mid social class, and low social class. But we did spend a lot of time with people that had been through hard times in our missionary work in Spain. And to contrast that, one time on the Lakers, Mitch Kupchak came in and he was talking about the team charter. And he said, hey, you know, we've got this charter. It's still going to be great. There's still going to be a lot of leg room. And there were some people in the room that had been upset about certain aspects of the charter the year before. And I understand where they're coming from. And, hey, look, when you play 40 minutes a night, sometimes in consecutive cities, you need – it's not that you need comfort. You just need a place where you can rest. And so I get it. And I'm not making a criticism of my teammates that wanted a more comfortable charter. But that is a contrast. That's a big contrast. In terms of what I saw personally in Spain, and then just the NBA lifestyle where you do stay in Ritz-Carlton, you do stay in the Four Seasons. But at the same time, I don't want to diminish the hard work of the NBA, because playing 40 minutes in an NBA game is, look, it's nothing. It is nothing compared to what the men and women in the military do, compared to what millions of blue-collar workers do around the country, around the world. But it is still not easy to play 40 minutes where everything you do on the court is scrutinized. You do it again the next night. You know, I've seen guys go up for layups and get their legs taken out, and they come down and land on their neck, taken out on a stretcher. And again, as I say this, I cringe, because I think about the men and women in the military, and it's no comparison. It's no comparison.
We've got a couple minutes left here, and you know that Stanford is certainly a different environment and circumstance than, say, maybe Kentucky is, and I'm not trying to put down Kentucky, except, you know, after one and done, they're gone off to the NBA. That's not usually the circumstance at Stanford, and I can't think of anybody that's left after just 1 year. But the message to your players there as an assistant coach, is it different because of just that most of those kids are there not only to play basketball but also to get a pretty darn good education?
It is a good education. And look, there's a lot of schools that offer a great education. I feel very lucky to have gone to Stanford, and I loved it. At the undergraduate level and at the Stanford GSB, I absolutely loved it. But you're right. The message that I'm going to share is, I want every single player that wants to have a professional career, whether it's in the NBA or overseas, I want them to have that. I want them to be able to play a long time if that's what they want. But I also want to remind them that the professional days of playing basketball will come to an end. You know, even the best players, the game ends and you move on to the next phase of life. And so I just want to kind of look, when I was playing, people would come in and they would tell us that, but I didn't really believe it. I didn't really think that. It's just hard to think about it when you're playing and you're on top of the world as a player. You're playing great. You're winning championships. But the message I'm going to give to the players is, hey, take your professors out to lunch. Get to know them. Get to know the PhDs in your program, because they're doing interesting things. And explore the interests that you might have away from sports. You know, maybe it's astronomy. Maybe it's engineering. The good thing about Stanford now is, most of the athletes at Stanford go to summer school. And so you have more time to explore some of these classes with less pressure. You know, it's hard to take 3 or 4 classes during the winter quarter where you have 3 or 4 finals during March Madness. But now you can kind of spread things out a little bit more, so you can have more of a broad academic experience.
I got to tell you, I have found this discussion insightful and enlightening, and I think people around the world, as they listen to it, are going to feel the same way. I can only just tell you, as we get ready to sign off here, I was on a charter for the football team when I was doing the play-by-play at Stanford, and I'll never forget it, walking down the aisle and looking at all the players that were reading the Wall Street Journal. Hey, Mark, I've thoroughly enjoyed this. Let's stay in touch, my friend, and you're welcome back here anytime on Sports Byline. Take care.
Thank you for having me on, Ron. Take care.
Right. Mark Mattson, they called him Mad Dog, and, of course, played 9 seasons in the NBA, the first 3 with the Los Angeles Lakers, where he picked up a championship ring not once but twice, and also he played 6 years with the Minnesota Timberwolves. We continue with more of you and Sports Byline.